Today on Wings, on October 24th, 1975, 90% of the women of Iceland walked out on strike. How'd that work out? Stay tuned.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
When 90% of Iceland's women walked off the job and out of their homes one morning in 1975, the country came to a standstill. They refused to work, cook, or take care of the children, and they brought their country to its knees and catapulted the island nation to its status as one of the best places in the world today to be a woman.
Hope Katz Gibbs is the founder of Incandescent Media and host of the video and audio podcast Truly Amazing Women. On the 50th anniversary of Iceland's women's strike, she interviewed Pamela Hogan and Rafnhildur Gunnarsdóttir, producers of the groundbreaking new film, The Day Iceland Stood Still.
I got the opportunity to watch this film. It's breathtaking, it's funny, it's beautiful, and it's life-changing for women everywhere. So, Pam, you are an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, journalist, and media creative. You have won the best TV show of 2015, named by the New York Times. You were co-creator and executive producer of the PBS series Women, War, and Peace, and so many more amazing things. And Harappa, you are a native of Reykjavik, and you've produced numerous acclaimed films on the Icelandic women's movement, including Women in Red Stockings, about this feminist wave, and the kitchen sink revolution of the women's movement of the 1980s evolution. Pam, what made you want to create this film?
Well, I was raised by a single mother in Boston, and she was a copywriter for an advertising agency. And one day she learned that she was making 50% of what the men with the same job were making. And she became an instant feminist. She became the first director of the National Organization of Women in Boston. And when I was like a freshman in high school, she would take me to the Massachusetts State House to lobby for the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment with her. Unfortunately, on the first day in one of our first meetings, an assemblyman said to me, "Young lady, do you really want to go to war?" And I said, "No, I do not." So she had to do a little more briefing with me. So as you know, we did pass the ERA in Boston, in Massachusetts, but it came very close to passing nationally, didn't quite make it. And, you know, I'm very grateful to her and her cohort of feminists for breaking ground for me, my generation, and subsequent generations. No question our lives are better off because of them, but I'm so aware that our feminist movement just stalled at a certain point, a long time ago, actually, to the point where today we're like the only developed country in the world that doesn't even have one day of guaranteed paid maternity leave for women. So I went to Iceland on a family trip like 10 years ago, and I read about this women's strike. And I read about it just like in the back pages of the Lonely Planet Guide. And my head exploded. I just thought, wow, like, how do you get 9 out of 10 women anywhere to do the same thing at the same time? But also, how could we not know about this story? And how is it that they managed from that day to continue making such strides forward to the point that, yes, while they're still fighting today, they're not quite there. They're ahead of the rest of us. And I just became obsessed by the story. I then called Frappa. Everybody said, "You have to talk to Frappa. You have to talk to Frappa." And what happened next?
Well, I get a call from this crazy American who says to me, "Well, I would like to make a film about the women's day off in 1975. And I'm like on the phone and they're going, haven't we done that? And then I started going through it in my head. We've done this and that, and I've done this small thing. It's like, no, we haven't done it. We agreed to meet. And quickly I felt that Pamela was somebody I could easily work with. And onward, you know, the journey started.
The long journey.
The long journey.
You said during the interview at the press club, it took you years to get to this place. Talk about the process.
Well, I discovered the story in 2015. I came home and had the great luck of getting a small development grant to do some research and an initial shooting. And it was when I went back for that shoot that we met and decided to team up. Honestly, Hope, I've had a really good track record of raising money for projects that I think are important. And I thought this was going to be a breeze. I mean, I couldn't remember hearing of a story that I found more compelling. But one door was slammed after another. The traditional sources of funding, you know, foundations and so forth, just for whatever reason, you know, we weren't rising to the top. Either we got rejected or we were, you know, we made it to be a finalist and we didn't quite make it, or we just literally never even heard back from them. So what happened was, which was kind of cool, this kind of grassroots method of funding started. Because what happened was, when I got back from that shoot, worked with an editor to create a trailer from these interviews. We didn't have animation yet. We had a little bit of archival footage, but we had really strong interviews with the women. And Hope, word started getting around. Next thing you knew, the trailer was being shown on the floor of the General Assembly of the United Nations for Pay Equity Global Initiative. Like, what? and community screenings were being held. And people were saying, wait, I need to know how to stay in touch with you. I want to send you money for my family foundation. That's how we started getting the funding. People were hearing about it and saying, that's important. I want to help that story get made, which was really kind of wonderful. And then as the years went by, we get into the COVID lockdown, and Krupp and I, our hands were tied at that point. You know, you really couldn't do any production. There weren't even any planes from New York to Reykjavik. Plus, you had to be very careful of, you know, these were older women. And at that point, Krupp said, let's just bite the bullet. There's funding sources here in Iceland. It involves a lot of paperwork, but we can do it. And, you know, thanks to Krupp and her incredible relationships there, we did get all the final funding we needed from several sources in Iceland.
Amazing. How many women did you interview? How did you bring in the animation? And then what was the final push to get it to theaters everywhere?
We interviewed dozens of women. What we wanted to create was like a collective portrait of Icelandic society at the time, men and women, and not just talk to the radical feminists. Of course, they were incredibly important to the story, and they were the first people that we interviewed. But we wanted to give viewers a sense of what it was like for just an ordinary person working at a bank or at a dairy who isn't in the movement, but starts to hear this conversation that the feminists are starting. And it starts them thinking, and then they're trying to decide, well, on that day, on the day off, should I participate, should I not? So actually, we really needed all that time, because none of those people were on the record. I mean, there aren't books written about this. I wish we could have just based it on a terrific book that had been heavily researched by some fabulously brilliant person, but unfortunately, just didn't happen. So we had a team of researchers. And someone would say, well, I heard of someone else. I mean, I think I had 1,000 cups of coffee with people I'd heard about in Iceland who might have an interesting story to tell. And Krupp, of course, had lots of leads. So it really was dozens of interviews. Unfortunately, we couldn't fit them all in the film. But we're going to give all the interviews to the Women's Archive in Iceland so that people will have access to it for posterity. But maybe, Krupp, you can explain about the animation.
Well, yes, we were having trouble locating archival footage, and we found out eventually that on the actual day, the TV had had three crews out for all of the afternoon filming a lot, but all that remained in the archive of the state station were 15 minutes of footage, because at the time they erased. They were reusing the tapes. They didn't realize how historic this whole event was. And so they erased the footage. It's gone. But we brainstorm about what we're going to do. And Pamela said, well, what about animation? And I was just like, that's expensive.
It can also go very wrong.
But boy, we were so lucky, or girl, we were so lucky. We found this great young man, Joel, through American contacts. And it was just an unbelievable journey, because, you know, animation can reach a younger audience. And it gave us kind of artistic freedom to really render the scenes that we felt that we needed to render. And it ended up being really a good step to take.
Yeah.
Very well done.
Thank you. I think it's kind of cool that Joel Orloff, our animator, was 29 or 30 years old when we hired him. That's just about the age that these women were when they were so idealistic and working every day to change the foundation of their society. And I really think he channeled their youthfulness. So did our composer, Margaret Rand. She also was 29 or 30. And when you hear her voice, I feel like you're hearing the voices of these women as they were when they were young, dreaming of changing things. The other thing Trapa was alluding to is that by working with animation, we weren't just sort of, if someone talks about a bank, he draws a picture of a bank. But we were tapping into the emotions and the dreams of the women. So when they tell us a story about, I wanted to be a captain of a ship, and they said, no, you can't, you're a girl. He shows her piloting this fabulous ship, and then everything goes up in smoke. It all dissolves into a wave. And that's a feeling. There's a feeling you get from that of what a little girl would feel like when somebody dashes her hopes that way. So I think that's what you meant when you said it enabled us to be more creative and to really give you the feeling of how they might have expressed it to you at the time, not now, 50 years later, sitting in a chair. That was really a beautiful thing. Also, he really got the humor and the playfulness. He just got that from day one.
I want you to talk a little bit more about how funny this is and how spectacularly brave these women were. Rapa, can you tell us more about Iceland and what was going on at the time as you understood it? What were women facing and how has that changed over the last 50 years?
Yeah, at the time of the strike, I was 11 years old. I was selling papers on the street and I did feel a lot of difference between us girls and the boys. Women were not paid as much as men, just like in America. You know, like in the fishing factories, they were standing side by side doing the same job and women were paid a lot less money. And that was how it was in most of the society. There was lack of childcare. There was not great support, you know, after a pregnancy. Women had just had enough. And the women that were organizing this, they felt that they were behind the Europeans and the Americans at the time. So they wanted to do something spectacular. And so when 1975, the UN announces that it's Women's Year, they just grabbed the idea and they ran with it and came up with something unique because they wanted to show men that you could not run the society without them. So 90% of women participated in one way or another. And I remember waking up the next day because I was on the square that day. And I thought, well, you know, now everything's going to be fixed. Of course, that took a lot longer. But this idea had been put into the minds of the people.
On Wings, you're listening to Pamela Hogan and Rafnhildur Gunnarsdottir, co-producers of the new film, The Day Iceland Stood Still. It looks at the nationwide strike in 1975 and its aftermath, using interviews, archival footage, and animation. Hope Katz Gibbs interviewed them for her podcast, Truly Amazing Women.
There were a couple of milestones, but the big milestone came 5 years later when we had our president voted in, Vigdís Finnbogadóttir, the first democratically elected female president. A couple of years after that, they established an all-women's party that ran for the city council. A year later, an all-women's party that ran for the parliament, which created this environment that all the other parties that had usually just had men on the top list, they decided, okay, we have to put women also in the top seats of our lists. So that changed dramatically from 3 women in the parliament to 12. So all of a sudden you had issues that related to half the nation being talked about inside of the parliament. And that makes enormous difference. So since then, we have been on this road to equality. And now 15 consecutive years, Iceland has been identified by the Gender Index as the best place in the world to be a woman. I mean, we think, yes, we are, but we still have some things to win. We still have to fight for change. And as a matter of fact, there is going to be a woman strike when the anniversary is happening. Still, Iceland today, you have women holding almost all the reins of power. The prime minister is a woman. The president is a woman. The three party leaders that lead the government are all women. The head of the parliament is a woman. The bishop of the national church is a woman. The mayor of Reykjavik is a woman. The chief of police is a woman. And so we have really gone overboard. I mean, we've gone to the other side. But I think, you know, that's to be expected in an equal society, I guess.
Iceland is the only country in the world that requires businesses to pay men and women equally, and they have to file papers every year. And if they don't, then they have to pay a penalty. And it's the only country in the world that its government has pledged to reach full equality, they say within 7 years or so. And there is 1 year of shared parental leave between the man and the woman, between the two parents, which is pretty extraordinary. And I think a lot of that comes down to having a substantial percentage of women in elected positions for many decades now.
It's globally altering to see that, especially with women being still pushed aside here. I wonder, though, what would an 11-year-old standing on the square during the next strike think similarly or differently than what you felt when you were 11?
That's an interesting question. I do have one story. Our president, Vigdis, sat for how many terms?
Four, 16 years. Yeah.
16 years. And in 1996, when she says she's not going to run, there were, of course, new candidates. And there was this one boy who was 6 or 7 at the time. And he said to his brother, "I didn't know men could be presidents."
My kids are 26 and 30. And I'm really hoping that this generation will continue to change things and demand equality. I mean, it's so crazy here in the U.S. It's hard to know what to make sense of anymore or how it's going to play out, right? Every day it just gets like, what, you know, like, I mean, the animation would be very helpful for us, right? But speaking of which, I want to go back to that ship because I was really struck by that scene. Give us a little context for the women that were working on the boats.
That story was unknown, but I was talking with one of the people who started the strike, and she said, "Oh, by the way, in the next office is a woman who works here, and her mother did something amazing that day." And so this woman came in and told me the story, and my jaw just, wow. I thought, that's a movie in itself. But, you know, part of the challenge of being a documentary filmmaker is you need to establish trust with the people who are going to agree to be in your film. And it ended up that although she was incredibly proud of what she'd done, and she's an extraordinary and a strong woman, she was just nervous about being on camera. Did a dance over the next 5 years and just couldn't quite get there. And then she saw a series that Hruppa made. She went to the theater and saw it and thought it was terrific. And that gave her the confidence to say, "I'll meet with you if you just record me in the audio." Hruppa did. And we would not have that story otherwise. And then, of course, without the animation, you wouldn't get the feeling that you're there on the ship.
Tell us a little bit more about those women, because that was one of the scenes that struck me as I was watching the film, that these women worked on a ship. And they were sort of given some power, you know, responsibility. But then how it unfolded for them. Tell us more about that story, because I think it's really a great example of how opinion shifted because of the strike.
Yeah, well, I mean, they had these three mates on this ship. It was a freight ship that was going, I think, to Russia.
To Russia, carrying timber.
Yeah, no.
Yeah,
they must have been carrying fish.
Oh, and bringing back timber.
Yeah.
That's it.
Bring that up. Yeah. There's this ringleader, this lady who is named Gila. And she says to the other two mates on the ship, they said, "We're going to go on a strike." And so that's what they announced, that they were going to go on a strike. So they brace themselves, they lock themselves up in the cabin, and they stay in the cabin in their pajamas all day while the guys are like knocking, "Come on out, you have to cook, you have to clean, what's going on?" And they're getting very pissed off. And, you know, even the captain is like knocking on the door, you know, but they stuck it out.
Also, the guys were getting hangry. So as lunch approaches, it's not so funny anymore.
Yeah. And the next day, the captain orders them to come up to the cabin. But part of what they did, the women, is that they had a telegram sent to the square. They didn't know who was going to read it or if anybody was going to receive it, telling them that they should all stick together, be it on land or sea. And then they put their names down and the name of the ship. So next day, they are called up to the cabin of the captain. They're like shaking in their boots going, oh, now he's going to fire us. And they go upstairs and he gives them champagne. They're like, what? So it turned out that the captain's wife had been on the square. And when she had heard the telegram read on the square, she became very proud. So she had him radioed in on the ship radio that evening. And she said to him, well, you know, you have heroes on your ship and you better treat them nice.
It could have turned out so differently.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. They could have been tossed overboard. Or something crazy like that. But that kind of power, I mean, this is not the first time in history, right? There's plays about this, women having sex strikes, they won't sleep with their husbands unless the war ends. But talk about what's happening in 2025 around the world and the women's movement from your perspective and the impact that this made 50 years ago and how you see it playing forward.
We have had an amazing rollout of the film, which seems to be inspiring women around the globe. Germany came in very strong. You know, they seem to be very frustrated. Ireland has invited the film because the Irish women are very pissed off that they only have 23% females in the parliament. On the 24th, it's going to distribution in 30 theaters in Japan. And that's because they want to have a strike next year. So it seems like the film is, thankfully, seems to be inspiring for women around the globe, which is exactly what we would like to see. The Icelandic example shows that, okay, it's not easy to change anything, but it can be done.
I was with the film in Seoul in South Korea, and our audiences were full of women in their 20s who are part of the movement that's challenging the patriarchy. They had short hair. They weren't wearing makeup. They won't date men. They say they won't have children. And they were honestly hoped they had a notebook and pen and they were taking notes as they watched the film. And sort of storming me afterwards, I had to sign, you know, programs and things. You know, I was like a rock star for a minute. And a lot of them were really crying. And they said that they were learning that compromise could be a good tool, because that's, of course, what the Icelandic feminists did. They were willing to renege on the word strike and make it a day off so that every woman could participate, even women who certainly didn't want to be considered feminists. But anybody can take a day off. A day off is a nice thing. And they were also taking notes about the humor. Somebody in our screening last night, we had a terrific screening in Millerton, New York, said she was really impressed by the lack of stridency. She kind of raised her hand as a fist when she said that. And that her recollection of our 1970s movement here in the United States was stridency. I have to say that was mine too. And I'm not criticizing it because they made the changes in the way that they needed to make them. And I have benefited from them. But I think you see in the film, there was joyful use of humor for the women to keep their spirits up because there was a lot of criticism of them. That's something that was kind of a challenge to introduce into the film, because men today are not going to participate in our film and tell us that they opposed the strike or that they thought that the feminists were a scourge on humanity. But that is how many felt at the time. So we needed to show how courageous these women were in continuing to do what they were doing because they felt that it would be good for everyone in the long run. And so what we finally resorted to were having actors voice the criticisms that were being made in newspapers to convey that.
Yeah, you know, I felt like you struck absolutely all the right notes with it. You know, it's courageous, it's funny, it's well told, it's balanced, and you really get the point across. I think everyone should see this. I hope that it gets onto Netflix as soon as possible so that it's accessible to everyone, and Prime and whoever else has the courage to do it. I had the privilege of doing PR for the Uprising of Women Philanthropy, a book by 10 women from around the world talking about the women's funding movement. And it's kind of of the same thing, you know, how do you get something that's been here kind of in the background and push it forward so that we can inspire all girls everywhere to know how brave they can and should be? So what do each of you think we're striving for? What would be the perfect balance?
We'd like the world to look like Iceland.
Yeah.
Just be equal. I mean, it's terrible to look at the way things are shifting in many parts of the world. I mean, Afghanistan, and then the shift that's happening in America, that's frightening me a lot. I know the quilt of the country. Of course, it's a big country and it has many nations within it, but I don't like the way this direction is going at this point. And we see the right-wing shift in Germany as well. But, you know, the apartheid in Afghanistan and those things, it's a scary world. So I just hope that people realize, and, you know, not only women champion for equality, but that men also would do it the same thing and just allow 50% of this very creative force that humans are to blossom and be happy in their lives.
I hope that the film will help anyone who sees it, I would say, reimagine the possible. You see these ordinary women that truly did something extraordinary that they had no idea they could possibly accomplish. And even when they looked around at each other the next day, having had this proof of concept of what had happened, how the society had stopped that day, they still didn't know if going down the line, their society would change. And it has changed so profoundly. And I tell you, I was almost in tears when I read a line in the former First Lady Eliza Reid's book called Secrets of the Sprakkar. She wrote this during the COVID lockdown, and it's about Iceland's extraordinary women. And she says in there, it's not that Iceland is equal yet, but everyone in Icelandic society, men and women, agree that that is the goal. And I almost started crying because we don't have that agreement in our country. So that would be my goal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems so simple. It seems so obvious, but actually it's really a mountain to climb. You know, there's so many things that you wish you could fit them all into the film. As people said wonderful things, it didn't always fit the narrative at that moment. But when we interviewed the then president of Iceland, whose father burned the hot dogs, big tragedy, he said, you know, Pam, I feel like we in Iceland, we're climbing this mountain and we're climbing and we're climbing. And he said, Pam, we're not at the top yet. We're getting close though. And we're looking down, we're reaching our hand out and saying, come with us, come with us. We're going to get there together. And that's why I just think that Iceland could be a beacon and an inspiration. It is for me.
Oh, so beautifully said. And such a beautiful film, The Day Iceland Stood Still.
Wings thanks Hope Katz Gibbs of Incandescent Media for use of her interview with Pamela Hogan and Rafnhildur Gunnarsdóttir, producers of the new film, The Day Iceland Stood Still. There's a video of the full interview with clips from the film on YouTube. You can search for The Day Iceland Stood Still, or look for Incandescent TV, making sure the third letter is a K. Thanks also to your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.